Hello, everyone. I am Molly Wood.
I'm Kyle Rusnall. Welcome to Make Me Smart. We are joined, as always, by you, because none of us is as smart as all of us. Although I will say, Molly's on the road this week. Got to tell them about that. They get to do fun stuff. I don't.
That's true. Sorry. I know. Oh, sorry.
Sorry, not sorry.
I've been bopping all around, but I can't wait to talk about my field trip.
We are talking this week about the winners and losers in the global economy, in globalization, with Scott Tong from the Marketplace Reportage staff.
Reportage. And I'm super excited about that. I am also excited that we are going to announce what book we're reading for our next book club. Place your bets right now, ideally in $2 increments. But first, it has been... It's just been way too long. I was like on vacation and we didn't get to have our editorial meeting for 2 weeks in a row. And we are long
way
overdue, my friends,
overdue
for a news fix. The news fix is the part of the show where we talk about the things that are happening in the news that matter to us and to you. And I have to say, before I get right into it, that I have the weirdest sense of mental disconnection happening because I'm in Washington, D.C. right now.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like there should be all this hubbub, but of course there's not because the president isn't here, and so I haven't seen any motorcades or anything like that. But it's just been really – I'm just going to take a moment and say that I have been using my evenings to not network, and I hope I don't get fired for saying this. I'm sorry, you guys, but I didn't go to the PRX party.
I never network. When I'm on business trips, I never network, man. I mean, you know, anyway.
Days are for networking, and nights are for wandering the streets of Washington. Yeah. And I'm staying really close to Federal Triangle. And so I walked down to the first night I was here, I walked over to the White House. And that was Monday night. So that was, you know, post, that was Monday, you know, whatever, August 14th. Immediately after the president had morally equated the white supremacists with the protesters and then reversed course on Monday. And everything was just feeling so up in the air and in disarray. And I went over and I walked to the White House and it was beautiful and serene and historical feeling. And I just stood there and I thought, I believe in this moment that this house is bigger than whoever's inside of it. Whoever is inside of it. And I was sort of seized by all of the weight of history. And it was really profound. And last night I walked to the National Mall and looked at the monument and the Capitol building. And I just had all of those same feelings. And I had some feels. That's all.
Yeah, well, Washington does that to you. I mean, say what you will about the politicalness of the place, but the city and its history is kind of remarkable in a lot of ways, which kind of goes to the thing we're going to talk about here. And it comes to us in a question from Shailene Modi. Here you go.
Hi, this is Shailene calling.
Shailene.
Hope everyone's
my
well.
My bad.
How are U.S.-based businesses with international interests and customers responding to a customer base that appears to be interestingly divided along nationalist versus globalist lines? Have some companies picked a side or walking the line between or something else? And do they even like nationalist or globalist entering the customer demographic lexicon? Thanks so much.
Wow. All right. So first of all, apologies for pronouncing the name wrong. My bad. But
you know what, Kai? I should have done it because I want you to know I've known Shailene forever because
he's
like a long time Buzz Out Loud listener. I only know him on the internet. But Shailene is the greatest and a really super smart, thoughtful guy. So I'm not surprised that question came from him.
All right. Well, it is a good question. And we're going to talk about the globalist and the globalism and all of that stuff a little bit later. But to that issue of companies and people and consumers and various factions in this economy picking sides, I would like to say, just as a way to get to our news fix, which is all about corporate America and the president of the United States, Molly Wood was right. If you go back and listen to the episode where she came up with this idea of companies as a check on the president, boom.
Really?
I'm just saying.
I thought you were going to say Molly Wood was totally wrong because I said these CEOs have a fiduciary duty to stay on the council and to try to be in the room and affect change. And now here they are. They have all fled and the councils have been disbanded.
Right. So let's back it up here. So what happened is, so we're recording this Wednesday. It's a day late. The president of the United States has just disbanded the Manufacturing Council and his policy advisory forum. And he did so right after being told that they were going to disband themselves.
I fire you first.
That is actually a true story because, as we know, the past couple of 3-4 days, CEOs have been bailing on those panels and fora right and left.
Yeah.
And we said in an episode not too long ago, well, actually, probably it was January or February, we had a conversation about the technology forum. And I asked Molly, how can these companies who believe in different things than Donald Trump does stay on these councils? And you answered appropriately that at the time, they have a fiduciary duty. They are for-profit companies. They have to be in the room helping make policy and making sure the president knows who they are and is hearing their views. And it's just interesting now that corporate America, after Charlottesville and after what has been a very long 7 months for corporate America in this economy where nothing to their benefit has happened, they're saying, you know what, we're done. And it's astounding.
Are they? I guess that's my question.
I think we have here.
Go ahead. You make your case, and then I'm going to make my case.
I think we have corporate America formally divorcing itself through these leaders of some of the biggest companies in America and in the world, divorcing themselves from the president of the United States, distancing themselves from his words. They have not seen any political progress on their agenda, which is tax reform, which is infrastructure. They've seen nothing from him. And now, as a result of his behavior in that press conference yesterday, Tuesday, they have said, that's it, we're done.
So yes and no. I felt like these were fairly low-cost departures, to be honest, other than Ken Frazier of Merck,
right,
who led this wave, who was the first to come out and say, all right, that's it. You know, this is a position that is untenable. I think it is inflaming, you know, racist hatred throughout this country, and I'm out. And the very next day, the article said he stands alone and no one's behind him.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a whole bunch of CEOs got a bunch of pressure to do this and followed sort of the PR wave. In fact, our producers were calling around,
yep,
early on asking companies, are your CEOs going to step down? They didn't have answers at all. There are, as our producer tweeted, a lot of happy PR people today, mm-hmm, because they're able, yep, to give what now appears to be the right answer morally as these CEOs say, we're going to step away. But they're stepping away from councils that hadn't met at all. And they're doing it at a politically expedient time. And I don't know that that is the same thing as a true check and balance. And I think it's a good PR divorce. But my question is, what can these companies really do to have an impact, a real check and balance in this country? And I guess I'm not sure what the answer to that is yet, but I don't know that we've seen it.
That's a totally fair point, and I'll give you that. And I guess I would say two things. One is that these are people, men, almost all of them, except maybe Mary Barra at GM, who's on one of the councils, and the CEO of Campbell Soup, who also formally stepped down before they got disbanded today, is a woman as well. But these are people who don't need to be literally at the table to have influence on policy. If, and I'm going to quote Larry Summers here, the former Secretary of the Treasury, if you're the CEO of Walmart and you can't get Paul Ryan on the phone or John Kelly at the White House or, frankly, the President of the United States on the phone, then you are doing your job wrong and you ought not be there. So this idea that they have been putting forward about that we need to be at the table for policy reasons, I think that is bunk, and I agree with Larry Summers. To the bigger point of whether this is political and a symbolic move, yes, it absolutely is. But I think in politics, and especially in politics at this level, symbolism matters. And I still say that corporate America today has divorced itself from the president of the United States. Now, it could be that in a week and a half, they have another kumbaya thing and everybody's, oh, yeah, Mr. President, you're a great guy, because that's what was happening in January.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for now, the play on this story is that corporate America has said to the president of the United States, you're on your own. And we should say, it'll be really interesting to see what happens the next time he gets in front of a microphone. Because we know that he reacts viscerally to these,
yeah,
things. He reacts from the gut. He reacts emotionally and not always in a considered way. And he's going to take this personally. I mean, we've,
yep,
seen that. And I just don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think that will be the very interesting. The part where it is not low cost, it is true, is the part where these all end up as scores to settle in his mind.
Oh, yeah.
So what does that mean for the business community? And so it is taking a risk. It's a risk as a group. So it's, you know, the risk is a little more shared. It's not like he's going to go after one company in particular and their stock's going to go down. Although it seems like the market has mostly moved on from that, because even when he attacked Ken Frazier of Merck,
yeah,
and you know, went after him on Twitter, Merck's stock stayed where it was. But
yeah,
I guess my question is, you know, as news outlets and pundits start to say, okay, what can be done? What can be done if the president is increasingly isolated, even from his own party? And we are even starting to see what appears to be mild rebuke from Paul Ryan.
Wait, I missed that. Was there rebuking from Paul Ryan?
I mean, let's not get crazy. It wasn't rebuking, all right. But it was a clear, you know, this must not be tolerated and has to be condemned.
Right. Okay. So it was the standard. Yeah. Okay.
Well, it was in thoughts and prayers. I mean, it was like, this is not okay. And you need to say it's not okay. But he didn't say it, dear President Trump, you have to say it's not okay. He just said, boy, right. Someone should really say this is not okay. So if businesses are going to find themselves in the position of being a true check and balance, what does that look like? For example, it was pointed out that during the healthcare debates, health insurance companies, by and large, had a ton of power, could have exerted a great deal of pressure, and didn't. Really did stay on the bench until sort of the very last moments of that debate.
Mm-hmm.
So what does it look like if companies really come off the bench? And I don't know the answer to that, but I'll be interested to see.
Yeah, and that will be an order of magnitude more significant than saying I'm bailing on this panel that hasn't met in 6 months anyway. That's totally true.
Exactly. Like that to me, like sure, they haven't gotten their tax cuts, but the stock market's booming. You know, there's still, I don't think we have still seen anything yet that poses an actual danger to doing business in this country. And in fact, behind the scenes, we have seen, as you know, lots of business friendly moves, lots of regulations going away, mm-hmm. lots of mm-hmm. moves toward. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I guess I'm saying I'm not that impressed by these CEOs leaving. I'm glad they did at this point, but I don't know that that actually translates into the kind of political move that could have a real strong impact.
All right. I'll take that.
I don't expect them to come out and say, please don't, you know, please regulate us some more. But I don't know. Maybe that would help.
No, I think that's totally fair. I think that's totally fair and a good point. Would anything else we need to say about that, or are we done?
I mean, I'm exhausted. Oh, I do want to just issue our usual reminder, though, to pay attention to the stories that are just slightly below the fold in the headline department, such as the Justice Department asking for 1.3 million records on individuals that visited an anti-Trump website, and the administration apparently quietly taking out language about the definition of sexual discrimination that, you know, organizations are now filing Freedom of Information requests to find out what the Justice Department's policy actually is now with respect to sexual discrimination. Like, there's still a lot going on under the scenes, behind the scenes, that bears a lot of watching. So just keep your eyes open. Take Twitter off your phone.
Did you take Twitter off your phone in wherever the heck you were?
So I went to Mexico. I took Twitter off my phone. I put Twitter back on my phone on Monday morning when I got on the airplane. I looked at it for like 4 minutes, and I felt myself descend into a morass of darkness and toxicity, and I deleted it again. And I haven't put it back on.
Wow.
In the morning, I have been reading the news. Like, I've been going to the Wall Street Journal app and the New York Times app and the Washington Post app and The Hill. And I've been reading actual news stories instead of looking at Twitter. And I may be 20 or so minutes behind everybody else's curve, but I feel a lot calmer.
And there is something to be said for calmness. All right. Send us your thoughts about... all the stuff that's been going on, really, because holy cow, there's too much to list. You can do it by writing to us at makemesmart@marketplace.org or just go to our website, makemesmart.org. Hit us on Twitter if you like. She's at Molly Wood. I'm at Kai Rizdahl.
And I'll see it eventually. I'll see it eventually.
I was just going to say, that's pretty funny. Yes, you will. You're not going to stay away forever.
I will totally see it. I'm not. I'm not off. But I'm limiting. Shalene, we did not get directly to your question in the news fix about how companies are viewing globalists versus nationalists, but it sets up the entire conversation that we are about to have herein when Scott Tong joins us to talk about globalization, like all of it, because Scott Tong is really good at that kind of thing. That's coming up in just a few seconds.
So here's the thing. We noticed the other day that y'all have asked us almost 1,000 questions. That's sort of online. That's the website-based version. Mm-hmm. You've emailed us a bunch more. But if you go to makemesmart.org, there's a little box where you can type in a question. And those questions are what help us figure out what you want us to be talking about once we, you know, get the news fix stuff out of the way that we blather about. And that's important stuff.
It is important. And like you said, we found out just recently that since the show launch, we've gotten almost 1,000 of those. We also do this live editorial meeting almost every week. It has languished in the face of vacation, travel, and unfortunately next week, the solar eclipse. But it definitely happens most Mondays at 12 noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, and all of the other time zones, because they all matter.
That's on me.
If you follow our Facebook pages, facebook.com/KaiRizdahl, facebook.com/MollyWood, you will get a little notification when we're going to go live. If you don't want to log into Facebook, though, and this is important, you can still join us. You can actually watch the video, even if you're not logged into Facebook. If you want to comment and ask us questions via Twitter, we will be there watching, even me. Probably on my phone.
Probably. One question we got on Facebook not too long ago was pretty interesting, because it kind of brought together two of our recent shows. The chat we had with Ken Rogoff about growth and the conversation we have or are having today about globalization. Here it is.
Make me smart.
Hi, my name is Constantine from Greenville, South Carolina. Is there a limit to how much economic efficiency can contribute to growth? Recently, I looked at the World Bank data for world per capita GDP to see if it has been growing faster over the past 20 years or so when globalization and other efficiency drivers have been active. I expected to see that on the whole, globalization increased GDP growth because it makes things more efficient. To my surprise, I saw no sign of increasing growth. Trade barriers are inefficiencies, right? So why does removing them contribute nothing to global growth on the whole? Have we reached some kind of limit in the usefulness of efficiency?
Holy cow, Constantine, there's a whole lot in there.
Amazing.
Yeah, but it's actually a really good question. It's completely timely, too, because on Marketplace this week and last week, I guess, and maybe coming up next week as well, we're doing a series on globalization. It's called Trade-Off. And what we did was we got Marketplace's Scott Tong on the line to talk about what globalization actually means, what it is, where it goes, and it's a little thing we do. It's a little game.
Time for the game that makes you smart. Five questions about one word. Here it comes. Podcasting's most exciting 3 to 4 minutes.
3 to 4 minutes. Not, you know, 5 minutes, 27 seconds. It's 3 to 4 minutes. We started.
It's podcasting, man.
I know. We started with the most basic question, as we always do in our most exciting 4 minutes in podcasting. The basic question is, what is globalization?
It is this process. It's this process of moving all kinds of stuff across borders. T-shirts, investments, people, banking services, ideas, bad music. I mean, it's why the typical innard in your car and mine has crossed a border 6 times on average in its life. Right? It's why my hockey team, the Washington Capitals, have a center named Evgeny Kuznetsov, which is very important to this conversation. Globalization is something that governments have to actively allow, right? Stuff to cross borders. It doesn't happen organically.
Who does it affect then?
I guess the easy answer is it affects everybody. I mean, one way to think about it is to think about producers and consumers. So let's take producers. Well, there's this really old 200-year idea in economics called comparative advantage. Actually, 200 years old this year. Mm-hmm. Every country makes what it's good at and trades what it's bad at. And in the end, you know, the producers who are best and cheapest at making something win, they make the most at the expense of producers that are more inefficient and more expensive. So this produces winners and losers. Jobs move. It's been happening for centuries. For consumers, the world gets more stuff, right? More avocados, more iPads, more crude oil, more soybeans for less money. I mean, by one index, and this is striking to me, the price of clothing today is the same as it was 3 decades ago. And this gets forgotten a lot in this globalization conversation. I think it's been dominated by the focus on producers and jobs. That's obviously important, but I think it's only part of the human welfare question here.
It has become incredibly divisive in this society recently because of politics, obviously, and the rise of Donald Trump. But even before that, it was contentious. How come?
I think it's been contentious in the developed economies, in the rich world. I mean, that's where, right, a lot of this kind of Brexit and this pushback has come from. A couple reasons. I think the story has been very compelling. There has been this hollowing out of jobs in the middle of the economy, right? Middle incomes, middle education, it's unmistakable. Now, whether that's mostly due to globalization or outsourcing is debatable, right? In lots of cases, jobs are taken over by electrons or robots rather than people in some other countries. But that's the narrative, and it's really powerful. I think that's part of it. And I would argue the focus has been disproportionate. I mean, a small fractions of Americans work in factories today, you know, less than 1 in 10 of us. And the big profits are in the service economy, which in many cases are hard to export.
Is there a cyclicality to globalization? I mean, you had the Brits and global trade and all of that, and now you've got us, or you have had us for a while, and we seem to be pulling back, and China and India are rising. Is there a pattern to it that you can discern?
Well, as I've been reporting this, I've come across two great big cycles. One is in the 19th century. We had steam engines and railroads and the telegraph making the world smaller. Coincides with the Industrial Revolution. But what's interesting is the boom is in two places in the world, Western Europe and North America. The rest of the world kind of gets left behind. So the big word that academics use is divergence, big winners and losers in the world. The second stage we're in now is convergence. We know the consumer class is rising in places like India and China. They're starting to catch up, although there's a long way to go for most of these people in other countries. The Nobel economist Michael Spence thinks we're about halfway through a century of convergence that's going on. So that means lives are going to get a whole lot better for billions of people, mostly further away. Other countries are going to grow faster than the United States, and probably it will bring more political tension.
So to that end, is there a way to keep score, right? I mean, we got this question from a listener. Is there data on whether globalization is good for the economy as a whole?
There is evidence as far as free trade. That is, historically, in times when we have free trade, the world's GDP has grown. And conversely, when the world has moved away from globalization, when drawbridges have been raised, we've seen how the world economy has shrank. And the object lesson here is 1930, the Smoot-Hawley tariff in the United States, right? It started off as an itty-bitty protectionist bill for a few American farmers. And then all the factory interests piled on, they joined the tariff party, and the U.S. put up these walls on thousands of goods to foreigners, right? Our stock market then crashes in late 1929. Other countries are tipping into recession. They put up walls too, right? Everybody loses customers somewhere else. World trade collapses. The depression gets deeper across the world. We've seen the movie of what happens when countries actively move against free trade, against globalization. And the lesson is what some call the golden rule of protectionism, right? Tariff unto others as you expect others to tariff unto you. It happens.
We are now in a decades-long trend toward globalization, as you said, since Smoot-Hawley, right? We've been expanding global trade. It's been on the rise.
Yep.
Is it possible that now, with the rise of Donald Trump and Brexit and some of the concerns over in the European Union, we have reached the apex of that trend, and now we're going to start going the other way?
First of all, I guess we don't know, but the smart people I talk to say the important factor is going to be, do countries take care of the losers? Most economists agree that free trade, as they say, in the aggregate, is a good thing. It makes the economic pie bigger. It creates more winners than losers. But what's happening is almost every country in the world has not taken care of its losers. Either it's kind of forgotten about them or it's tried and failed. And so we have people who have been displaced because of globalization, or it appears that way. And that's a powerful political force. And so how do you take care of that demographic? There isn't kind of this case study of a country that's done it perfectly. And I would think that if that question doesn't get addressed very well, then we could have more of these, right, very politically powerful people with compelling stories who are losers in the global economy, and the politics will follow.
So that was Marketplace's Scott Tong, one of the reporters on our globalization series. It's called Trade-Off, the Goods, the Bads, the Winners, the Losers. Sarah Gardner had a piece as well. I went to South Carolina and did a story. I mean, this is the future of the American economy. It's the future of the global economy, and we had best learn what it means.
It is remarkable for me to hear Scott tie the recession directly to protectionism. Like, I don't know that I completely realize that, and I don't know that a lot of people do. And then I think when you tie this sort of ensuing economic collapse to global collapse and war, like, you really start to tell you start to connect dots mm-hmm. in the way that is so profound for people. Scott has a great video about globalization on our website, marketplace.org. I also saw it on Twitter today. It's about why globalization looks like an elephant.
Oh, all right. I haven't seen that video yet.
Oh, my goodness. It also reminded me of my favorite book in the entire world.
Which is what?
The Little Prince, and how he draws a hat. Well, he draws a snake eating an elephant, and everyone thinks it's a hat.
Snake, right.
Anyway, that video for some reason made me think of that because I'm that much of a dork.
Wow. I had to read that in French. Never did it.
We will put a link, though, to that video.
Well, maybe not that show notes.
I mean, I don't know. Is it any dorkier than usual?
Maybe not that much.
You know.
I'm holding my fingers very close together. It's a little bit dorky. All of it leads us to a question. I'm going to mess this guy's name up. You're giving me all the hard names. A question from Jason. I'm going to roll the dice here. Kalazar. About the subject at hand and what it's doing politically, not just here, but all over the place. Here he is.
If the end of all economic activity is consumption and consumers have spoken loud and clear that they demand low prices, how ever will manufacturing jobs return to the United States? Those jobs left decades ago because it makes no economic sense to make goods here when they can be cheaply made abroad. Promises of bringing manufacturing jobs back make no sense to me. Please explain.
We make so much stuff in this country. We make so much stuff. But this is what has happened. This is David Ricardo, right? There are other countries now who can make what we used to make more cheaply. And that's just a fact of economic life. So what's happening in this country? We're making high-tech stuff. We're making clean-tech stuff. We're making stuff that takes like a freaking master's degree to work in a manufacturing plant. I was in Pennsylvania at a plastics manufacturer with some guy who had a master's degree in plastics technology. And he's literally a manufacturing company. We're just making different stuff. Sorry, I'll stop yelling now.
Oh, that was good. That was good yelling. No, I mean, I totally agree. Well, and I think I meet with companies all the time who are telling different kinds of manufacturing stories, and they do exist, and they are happening. It's just like, it is important to note that it is not going to be the exact same jobs. And the fact is, I think that it is a cop-out for companies to say, I have this rant all the time about airlines, where everyone will come out of the woodwork and say, you know, you have to, the airline's poor customer service doesn't matter because the consumer has spoken and the consumer wants low prices. Well, the consumer's wages also haven't gone up in 30 years. So there, you kind of have to, maybe it's 20 years, maybe it's 10, but you kind of have to take that with a grain of salt. Like, what is the chicken and egg question when you start to talk about prices? Are consumers asking for low prices because they don't have as much money in their pocket because there's a shrinking middle class? And all the way back to Constantine's question, has GDP not gone up? Has efficiency not improved because there is more profit taking? I don't know the answer to that, but that's how it sometimes feels. It's like, well, the rich are still getting richer. So what part of the economic cycle is broken there? Do we really want low prices? Because there's plenty of artisanal product companies saying, I'm going to do this all, you know, there's Shinola saying, I believe that you'll pay way more for my watch and my bicycle.
Right, which is faux artisanal.
Which is faux artisanal, but I did pay a lot for their watch. It worked.
Oh, I was going to buy one, but I was like, I can't afford that for a watch. But anywho.
You know, I bought it for myself for a big birthday. And then how does this all come back to Shalene's question about the companies? Because there's so much more than just, I mean, all the way back to the news fix, there's so much more than just economic considerations now, I think, involved in a company's decision. Or is there?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Am I fooling myself if I think that that's the case? Because does it really just come back to profit and shareholder value?
Well, kinda. It sort of does. But I think, who knows? This may be wishful thinking. I mean, I've always thought that it's incumbent upon corporate America, and I will speak only of American because I'm an American person and citizen and tax holder and shareholder in some companies. Although, full disclosure, I don't know what stocks I have because my wife handles our money. That's a true story. I like to believe that corporate America is coming to understand that its role in a representative democracy is more than just making money and this myth of shareholder value. But that's a whole thing we don't want to go down.
I mean, I want to believe that too. But I think you and I are going to have to just quit our jobs and found the Moral Capitalism Political Party and make it a reality because
wow,
I don't know if it's true or not.
Let's do it.
Right? Let's do it. Let's totally do it. I have a whole plan. Okay, but we're not going to ruin our plan. I'm not. No spoilers. Next up, you picked You, dear web voter, and probably Kai, who voted 1 million times, picked our next book club book. But before we tell you what it is, we got to pay the bills.
All right, here we go. It's that time again.
How to start a book club.
Books are fun.
I have my own book club.
Oh, I just can't wait to read a book.
Oh, my God, I never get tired of that. I want to do book club every week. You had five choices of book. We got more than 600 votes, 500 which came from Kai.
Hey, now, come on, man. Vote early, vote often. It's a democracy. Now, before we announce it, I want to play this one clip from Kay Gilbert. She sent us way back when we picked The Righteous Mind.
Thank you for instituting a book club. It's a great idea, even though, like Kai, I voted for The Man in the High Castle. Maybe next.
Boom. Maybe next. Yes, the next book is Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick. Uh-huh.
It's good to be the king.
I'm just saying.
Now, this book is fiction. The close second, actually, was Everybody Lies, which I think I'm just going to read on my own time because that sounded super interesting, the way that the like data manipulation book. But I am kind of excited to read some fiction. This book, I should say, does have some disturbing content. This is our like content warning, so just keep that in mind. It is also, though, not so long. It's 288 pages. There is a Kindle edition. There is also an audiobook, so there are lots of ways to absorb it. And there's a TV series about it on Amazon, as you probably know, so you can make the comparison between the book and the TV series and also between all of that and what those idiots at HBO are planning with that Confederate show.
I'm going to parenthetically insert here that HBO Confederate show, that's gone away. In light of Charlottesville, there's no way that thing sees the light of day.
God, I pray that you are right.
Yeah, there's no way it's happening. Bunch of you have already read Man in the High Castle and watched the TV show, some of you. John Maluso is one of them. Here's what he had to say.
I was a little bit nervous when the TV show came out, as we usually are, that they're going to be pretty different. And lo and behold, they were very different, but in a surprisingly great way, to the point where I actually enjoy the TV show more than I enjoy the novel itself. I think that the show did a great job of building out the world that Dick had only started to explore. I think that they're nice complements to each other and that you'll learn a lot from reading the original story, just as you learned a lot from the show.
That's cool. And I'm excited because I have done neither. So I'm coming at this with
really totally
fresh eyes.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. This is all new to me, like a certified pre-owned vehicle.
Wow.
Our listener, CJ, God, that was a car nerd moment. Our listener, CJ, points out that the themes in both are still really relevant today.
Hi, I'm CJ, and I'm an American who lives in Germany. Even after all these years, the war, or World War II, is still very much impacting the German culture, economy, and landscape. It's interesting to think about how that might be different. Also, Molly, don't be embarrassed about liking sci-fi. I love nothing more than an original story, and I almost never find them outside of science fiction. Try out the first 15 lives of Harry August after reading The Man in the High Castle. Thanks.
Well, there you go. You got a little prescriptive thing coming at you from a listener.
Well, and also, I know I love that. And also, I mean, let's not overlook the fact that the author of The Man in the High Castle, Philip K. Dick, is the man who wrote Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which inspired Blade Runner. Like, this is definitely in my wheelhouse. Now, unfortunately, Philip K. Dick is no longer with us in this reality, but his daughter is an executive producer in this reality. I just want to believe there's a parallel one. There's a parallel one.
You got to identify your realities.
Where like the singularity happened and he's still kicking. His daughter is an executive producer on the TV show, and we're hoping to have lots of really interesting conversations with people who have been influenced by this book, maybe her. So you have a month to read it, ish. And then we'll discuss, depending on like our progress.
Ish, yeah, right. It's all about how we do here, boss. It's, you know, I'm just saying, our deadlines are our deadlines. More coming up from you, straight ahead. Here with the Bitcoin mailbag.
Where do we mail a letter?
All right, we're going to try to speed through this because we're bordering on a 90-minute show right now and our radio people are freaking out. But much like Bitcoin, the listeners of that episode went into two separate groups. They forked, if you will, those who still wanted more clarification and those, not surprisingly, who had much more clarification to give. First up here is Tim Farrell.
My big question about Bitcoin is that the way I see it, somebody one day decided this is Bitcoin and it is this value. It's like they pulled it out of their wazoo. It's like they invented something from nothing. And now I see everybody who's just in awe watching the emperor walk down the street in his new clothes. I don't get it, even though you guys gave it a good shot at explaining it to me. I don't get any of it. Actually, and no pun intended, I don't buy it.
Oh.
Anyway, thanks. I really love the show.
So wait, two very quick things. One, I had a whole long Twitter thing going about up the wazoo or out the wazoo. And it occurs to me as I hear Tim say it out loud that out of the wazoo is an acceptable framing of that word. Otherwise, it's up the wazoo. Second of all, it's funny to hear Tim's voice because he and I have been Twitter buds for a very long time. And I look for stuff on Twitter and it's cool to hear his voice.
Oh, see, that's how I felt about Shalene.
Yeah.
Oh, see? God, the internet is great. Okay, here's the thing. Here's the reason that Bitcoins have value. And it fundamentally comes down to scarcity. You know? You can only create a certain amount, and it is really, 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 really hard to create more. So there's that basic thing about scarcity. The other reason is the blockchain technology, which is that you can track it. So it is totally tangible in the sense that you can see a recorded history of every Bitcoin that's ever been made and spent and exchanged, and you know when a new one has been created. And fundamentally, because it is backed by all of those various maths, as the British might say, and that there is a discrete amount of it, it is close enough to a currency. It has the characteristics of money and it can be exchanged and divided into smaller bits. And so, you know, but it only has value if people are willing to exchange it for goods and services or apparently invest in it.
Yeah. And people are, right? I mean, that's the thing. And look, I have no doubt that this is where things are going, right? That blockchain technology and Bitcoin or Dogecoin or whatever coin it's going to be is going to be something that we're all going to be living on in the future. The question is, how long is it going to take us to get there? And how long is it going to take people like my mom, who I think we talked about in the Bitcoin episode, how long is it going to take her to get in? And, frankly, will she still be alive when it happens? But that's a whole different conversation. Mom, I apologize if you're listening. All right. Anyway, we also had folks like my mom's not listening because she doesn't do podcasts. Brandon Gottlieb wrote as well. He's well versed in cryptocurrency. He's got a background in computer science, has some of his own money in cryptocurrencies, we should say. And here's what he had to say.
There are a couple topics that might be interesting to listeners in future shows. First is mining. Basically, it's the process by which all computers on the network agree that a transaction was valid and did actually occur. Computers that perform the process are compensated with units of the cryptocurrency. Mining in any blockchain has big economic implications, since miners have to decide whether the cost of suitable hardware and electricity will be worth spending on mining. Second is competition. It was mentioned there are many competing cryptocurrencies, but different blockchains have different technical purposes. Bitcoin provides only currency, whereas actual applications can be built with Ethereum. Different mining algorithms can cause major differences as well. This doesn't seem to be competition in the traditional sense. Bitcoin versus Bitcoin Cash now seems closer to traditional competition. Basically, two factions of Bitcoin users split based on changing rules that increase maximum speed of executing transactions. This has major economic implications since the faster transactions allow for more use cases of the technology. And third, the internet's often a strange place, and cryptocurrency isn't an exception. Check out useless Ethereum token. It's completely valueless, and one person just decided to get everyone to sink some money into it. And he apparently raised over $14,000 worth of Ether, which is probably worth even more now. But who am I to judge how people spend their hard-earned money? Keep up the great work, and thanks for making me smart.
Oh, no, there's nothing sinister about that dude at all. Brandon, I love you, man, and thanks for writing, but my God.
He freaking put music.
Did he score his own thing, or did we score him? We scored him. All right, we scored him just because it was a minute and 40 seconds long. We had to have something to carry it through, but... But oh my God, dude. Please. Oh,
that was so awesome. I was really hoping that he scored his own phone call because that would be so rad if you guys were just like taking it to the next level. Challenge issued. Finally, Meredith MC on Twitter wrote, I know I'm late to the party here, but Kai's cryptocurrency should obviously be, wait for it.
Wait for it. Wait for it.
The Riz dollar.
Boom.
Oh, that is so good. God, I'm just embarrassed that we missed that. That's freaking great.
You know,
I love the feedback.
We'll let the people speak to us. We'll let the people speak to us.
Yeah, you know what? You're absolutely right. It's in fact our entire job not to think of everything because that's what you're for. You guys are geniuses.
Oh my God, that's exactly right.
I know. It's so awesome and it's working. Please keep it coming. Keep it coming. MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org is our email address. You can just tell all your friends to listen to us and please give us a great review on Apple Podcasts today. I was dying because I went to this NPR session, which was wonderful, here at the Public Radio Program Directors Conference. And they were reading from their 5-star reviews on iTunes. And I was like, we have awesome 5-star reviews on iTunes. I could be up there right now reading those.
Were they really?
I'm not trying to throw shade.
That's so funny.
Tell your friends about our little podcast and review us, and maybe I too will get to present one of our 5-star reviews at the Public Radio Program Directors Conference.
Wow. Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Haley Hirschman, Emily Henderson, and our senior producer, Nancy Vergali. This week's program was engineered by Jake Gorski. Our theme music is composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Where's Ben anyway? I haven't seen him forever.
Ben's like off on Abbey Road making music because he got some amazing fellowship because Ben is the greatest.
Oh, well, that's cool.
Also the greatest, the executive producer of Marketplace, Satara Nieves, the senior vice president and general manager. So great, Deborah Clark. And now Kai also and I have to go gossip about the public radio industry. The end.
Everybody's fine. Everybody here is fine. Ba-wham.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.